Hello and a very warm welcome. I'm Renee Paul, an academic GP at King's and one of the faculty development leads for the King's undergraduate medical education programme in the community and in general practice. We've created a podcast series for busy healthcare professionals, educators, clinicians and students. We cover hot topics and top tips in healthcare education. Many of our podcasts are shorter form, 15 to 20 minutes, so you can squeeze them into your schedule. And there are some that are longer form, up to 45 minutes. We really hope you find it useful and enjoy listening. So, hello, Ashley, and a very warm welcome. I wonder whether you could introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us a bit about who you are and why you're here today. The podcast is about supporting and valuing learners and colleagues with neurodiversity. So we'd love to hear a bit more about you.
Thank you, Rini, for the invitation. Yeah, very delighted to be here. So my name is Ashley Liu. I'm a clinician, a doctor. So I'm a pediatric neuropsychiatrist. And I work with children and young people, especially who have brain conditions. So I work at the Evelina London Children's Hospital and also the South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust. And I guess my interest in this area is, firstly, from a clinical perspective, most of my work involves seeing children who present with neurodivergent conditions, and we'll get into what that means in a second, because that's very much something that occurs alongside some of the brain conditions that I see. So epilepsy, neuroinflammatory conditions, yeah, if they've got brain injuries. Actually, my interest in this area, and also particularly in terms of supporting learners and trainees across the kind of medical education spectrum, yeah, really stretches over quite a long period. When I was a new consultant, or even actually as a senior registrar, also always really interested in medical education and was involved in that. So teaching medical students and giving lectures at the medical school. As I got to see more children and young people with neurodiverse conditions, started to realize that actually I was probably seeing this in some of the small groups or the one-to-one teaching scenarios that I was involved with in the medical school, or actually at that time I was also teaching quite a number of different health professions across the multidisciplinary team. So nursing, psychology, for example. As I got more into education leadership, I started exploring this a bit more within the medical school, in the university a bit more broadly. This was in my previous role before I came to work in London. And we set up a pilot. It wasn't so much a service because it was just me, but halfway, I suppose, would be the best way to term it. I gave some education and training, and it was really to try give quicker access to medical students and other students across research kind of related areas to self-refer if they wanted to have a bit of a chat and then a discussion about how to potentially maybe seek a diagnosis for a condition like autism or ADHD. So ran that for a bit of time. It was really fascinating to hear some of the stories of the trainees and the students and the learners that were coming. And then as part of that pilot pathway, we managed to get some support and funding to, you know, start doing some assessments along that pathway, but also some support sessions along with other members of the multidisciplinary team. So some of my colleagues who work in psychology, for example. So really enjoyed that piece of work. Circumstances meant that I then moved down here to London. So I think the first qualifier, just to say, is that whilst I was very actively involved seeing the people, I suppose, that we're going to be talking about as part of this podcast focus, I'm not actively involved with that just now. I'm still involved with medical education, but maybe not in those roles supporting people with neurodivergent conditions particularly. I did want to also just quickly say another qualifier, which is that I don't identify with having any neurodivergent conditions myself. And I think that it's so important that we're hearing the experiences, potential challenges, also potential joys, you know, of how a trainee or a learner with a neurodivergent condition is negotiating their training or their life. And, you know, I'm here as much to learn, I suppose, you know, from those that have such conditions. It's really important, I guess, that listeners to the podcast, you know, are conscious that they should be seeking to hear direct experiences, you know, because that can never be replaced, isn't it? Even though I've heard many secondary accounts.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I really appreciate you kind of bringing that qualifier to the fore, because I completely agree. And I was really delighted when you came and did a talk for us, that actually you did a workshop with a student who had lived experience. And, you know, that was really that richness, I think, is not to be lost, but actually your expertise as well, I think, is invaluable for this conversation. I know you alluded to it before, but I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about, imagine most people know what neurodiversity is, but, you know, how you define it and what it covers.
There is actually a long form, complicated answer to that question, because the term was first coined actually in the late 1990s by a social scientist, Judy Singer, just to note the fact that when we think about aspects of diversity, whether it be in ethnicity or sexuality or gender, that neurotypes, as was coined at that time, you know, just different ways that our brains function, that there is a diversity across the population also. It very much became associated with a social movement, actually. So born out of social justice principles, tackling stigma around people who were diagnosed with neurodivergent conditions. So I used it in my presentation when I came to the conference. And I think that the focus of this podcast will probably be more its use as a paradigm, thinking about the ways that we think about and embrace conditions that we, from a medical perspective, I suppose, would diagnose as neurodevelopmental conditions, to consider them as differences rather than deficits, and to think in a strength-based kind of focus to try and understand more about the person as part of having that profile, that set of features or needs, rather than it being about a disease that needs to be, you know, cured or corrected. I think there is some ongoing discussions within even with advocates that would identify themselves as part of the neurodiversity kind of movement. So for example, you know, some people would argue that, you know, people with mental illness, for example, should also be considered to have neurodivergent conditions, and some would say not. So I think with any new social movement, you know, it's going to actively and organically grow, isn't it? And it will, differences of views and active debate, you know, it's always part of that shaping and emergence, isn't it, when it comes to overall kind of movement. But I think for the context of this podcast, I think it is referring to these differences. So neurodevelopmental conditions that are diagnosed like autism, ADHD, dyslexia, dyscalculia, Tourette syndrome.
Lovely, thank you. And I have to say, it really came across strongly when I heard you speak that we're all different and that we all have these differences. And actually, that's a far more helpful approach than thinking about someone with a neurodiverse condition as being atypical or the rest of the population being typical. And so I like that focus. And also really strongly came out for me the focus on strengths as well and that approach.
Yeah, I guess a comment about that. I think there's been also some pushback from folk to say, if you're only thinking about strengths, will that then dismiss some of the needs that certainly within current frameworks, so whether it be statutory legal frameworks, you know, like the Equality Act, even as pertains to the group that we're talking about, you know, so within medical students, you know, in terms of the Medical Schools Council or with the General Medical Council when it comes to doctors, that actually these are viewed and often termed as disabilities. And actually, most advocates within the neurodiversity movement would say that there isn't a contradiction, you know, that actually neurodiversity advocates for these conditions to be both a natural variation, so a difference, but also that actually they should access the rights that within current frameworks would term as a disability. So, you know, so they'll campaign for acceptance and respect for people with autism or ADHD, but also that they will fight for appropriate support and services, you know, from the medical school, you know, from the hospital, I guess, that the person is working in.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. I guess both can be true that, you know, this can be a disability and you can have strengths that go with it. And actually, if we're thinking about support for learners and trainees and maybe even colleagues, then actually we have to know what their rights are. So that really, thank you. That's a really helpful point to bring out. I'm really interested in what the prevalence is in the kind of the general population and then thinking about the groups that you've worked with, sort of healthcare students, doctors and other healthcare workers, you know, is there a difference, you know, thinking about our podcast in the setting of kind of healthcare education?
Yeah, so I guess the first thing to say is that I don't think there's been, you know, good empirical data to state the kind of prevalence in both, say, medical students and doctors for different neurodivergent conditions. The general population prevalences are well established. So certainly in the children and young people's populations that I often see, autism is about 1%, ADHD is between 5 to 8%, depending on the diagnostic criteria that you use, tics and Tourette's just under 1%. I did look up some of the small scale kind of studies that have looked at this. Most of them are cohort studies or kind of surveys. So obviously they bring along their own methodological limitations. There were some interesting points in terms of ADHD prevalence in medical students. One study found that just over a third of them had ADHD traits as part of using a screener, but only just under 8% of them had received a diagnosis. So I guess that kind of fits with some of the kind of general population figures. In doctors, the rates actually vary quite widely. You know, so from papers that would quote, for example, in America, I think you can state it as part of their version of the GMC, and that came up with quite a low prevalence, so under 0.5%. But then some other survey studies have come up with kind of figures up to 10%. In terms of autism, in doctors, it's estimated as about just under 1%. There's a really good organization called Autistic Doctors International that's doing some really good work, and they're building evidence, you know, even as we speak. In terms of medical students, I found this really interesting paper that I suppose it was more a commentary and discussing how having autistic traits, not necessarily being diagnosed with autism, might predispose you to STEM specialties, you know, so not just medicine, but across engineering and other kind of STEM professions. The figures that they quoted showed that actually it seemed to be less in medicine compared to, say, a very technical STEM subject like engineering, for example. And then within medicine itself, there seemed to be a signal that those medical students that were pursuing technique-focused career paths, so, you know, surgery, for example, maybe that they had higher kind of traits as measured by the screener called the autism quotient compared to those with more person-oriented kind of career paths. This doesn't really fit with the findings of that organization that I mentioned, the earlier Autistic Doctors International, because they would say that the two biggest professions within their membership from a specialty representation perspective are GPs, number one, and then psychiatrists, number two, which, you know, I think one would argue that those are two very person-oriented career paths rather than technique-focused, even though, you know, obviously within that, there's a diversity also. So yeah, some really interesting findings, which I'm sure will continue to be built on in terms of the evidence base.
And it's also making me think, I mean, that's fascinating, making me think about the prevalence of these traits and then actually when it might become a diagnosis and how we look for that, how we support our kind of trainees and our learners. So I wonder how some of those traits or a diagnosis might sort of present. What should we be looking out for?
Yeah. So I guess taking that very strengths-based approach, it might not present in a way that one would think, you know, oh, that's an aberration, isn't it? That's an atypicality, like you were saying that earlier, Rini. So it might be that actually how it's presenting, oh, sorry, I appreciate this is a podcast, I'm doing air quotes as I'm looking at you, are things that actually would be credited within either that specialty or just medicine in general. For someone who's autistic, you know, they might have a high attention to detail. They might be very organized. They might be very focused around quite a clear sequential way, or potentially even sometimes described as rigid way of following a protocol or a set of practices or a guideline. And all of those are, you know, well celebrated within medicine, you know, in most specialties. They could be determined or very single-minded as they focus on their objective. But yes, so someone who's autistic, you know, might also present with a very different communication style, both, you know, at medical student, OSCE kind of communication skills learning settings, or even as a trainee, you know, if somebody was doing an observed encounters with a patient, that's a very often used workplace-based assessment for trainees, that might be commented on because the assessor is approaching things in, you know, a quite fixed stereotype way of how we would interpret a good communication style. And someone who's autistic might be overwhelmed by sensory differences, so they might find the environment and some of the sounds or the kind of lighting difficult, and that might then cause a behavioral change. Someone with ADHD, again, from a strengths perspective, you know, might be credited as being enthusiastic, they're creative, you know, in an acute kind of situation, they seem to be the first person, very fast thinking skills around how to approach an acute scenario, but they might also be seen as impulsive, and that could be both in terms of their actions, they do something without thinking properly and considering maybe how the patient might respond to their actions, or emotionally impulsive, you know, so they react emotionally in a way that might be seen as being quite different from their fellow students or doctors, and they might be disorganized, so they might find it difficult to hold things in mind, to, you know, kind of almost the opposite of what I guess what we were saying there earlier with an autistic person in terms of how they then sequence things or kind of carry things out in an organized manner.
And so, yeah, I've certainly seen that in students who have told me that they think they might have ADHD and might want an assessment, that actually they were really kind of engaged and creative. But what I could never make sense of before, they'd sort of said, or maybe I might have, I'm considering whether I might have a diagnosis, is that they could never meet those deadlines, or, you know, they really struggled with their organizational skills. And I was thinking, oh, I wonder what's going on here. So I think, you know, on the receiving end as an educator, it's just noticing when maybe things don't always match up. And also, I think that's really important about thinking about what our norms are. You know, we have an idea of what good communication looks like in medicine. And actually, what if you can't maintain eye contact and that makes you feel uncomfortable? Can you, and I would argue you can, still have good communication skills? It's kind of making me think, how useful then is it to have a diagnosis? Because I appreciate not everybody will have one or want one. And I mean, I guess that's quite a personal choice. But if we were noticing signs or symptoms, or I'm just thinking as an educator, should I be the one bringing it up? And it's a difficult conversation if the person hasn't already thought about it.
So one concept I hadn't mentioned was that of masking. So that this term, born out of the autistic literature, refers to the sense that someone has some degree of insight to maybe some of their needs or some of the things that are different from others. And then they are consciously hiding it, I suppose. But, you know, they're finding ways to assimilate for their differences not to be seen so prominently. I think this is an important concept because when we see this in children and young people, for example, what often comes alongside that is the sense that it's very emotionally and physically exhausting for that child. So often hear of the child who seems to seem perfect in school, and then when they come home, they seem to have an outburst, you know, they seem to be very tired. The way that I would explain this to somebody who's medical in background is actually to try and think about role playing. So, you know, so how we're using simulation and role plays and, you know, OSCE type scenarios are very much in medical assessments now, isn't it? And, you know, myself and every kind of like, you know, one of my colleagues, you know, when we came out of an OSCE situation, we'll often say, oh, no, that was the most tiring thing ever, you know, to go through the kind of 12 stations, whatever, isn't it? And, you know, you're trying to get yourself into that mode of playing the right style doctor. That's the experience, I think, you know, of a lot of people, doctors and students with autism, with ADHD, where they're trying to mask their differences. And how that's relevant, I suppose, is also just being mindful that you might not see those differences in a very prominent way. So the teacher, educator, supervisor might not be seeing that. They might be hearing it maybe from other team members or colleagues who are concerned for that doctor or student. I think it is important how the difference is made clear to the teacher or educator. As per the principles of that neurodiversity movement, I think it's so important because we're discussing adults here, isn't it? So that's very different from maybe the children, young people that I see, where we know that actually being self-empowered, you know, forming and being patient with people in terms of their identity and raising that themselves is so key to lots of different things, you know, progressing from there. So for their own personal well-being, but also then to work in a collaborative way, you know, with the supervisor, the teacher, or the wider leadership or management, you know, within that institution to achieve, you know, best outcomes, you know, to find a way to be able to support the needs of that doctor or learner. I don't think that that's actually a formulaic way, I would probably say. I mean, I think it's about supervisors and teachers being conscious about the fact that this is a hidden minority, you know, amongst the learners and the doctors that we supervise or support. And, you know, to educate ourselves, to access training, to help us, you know, kind of face up to those conscious and unconscious biases, you know, so that when we do encounter it, you know, we can more comfortably, I suppose, interact with that individual circumstance. So, you know, so whether it be that individual conversation, you know, with the trainee that I'm supervising to say, you know, I've noticed these aspects, or someone has mentioned this to me, I want to give you as much time, you know, but I just want you to know that I support you. And actually, these are some possible places that I can then signpost you to. So, you know, for medical students, like student support services, for example, for a doctor, you know, occupational health, their quite a number of trusts now, actually, that will have specific resources and professionals that deal with neurodiversity.
Yeah, and so I think you're right. I think we can have those supportive conversations. And I guess you could signpost to generic support if you haven't got to a place where you're both talking about a kind of the same condition or some sort of neurodiversity. So it, I guess it's being led by the learner and seeing how they respond to you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So Mary Doherty, who leads Autistic Doctors International, I think she's written a paper which proposes quite a nice acronym of Autistic SPACE, so S-P-A-C-E being the acronym, where it goes through several areas that one might then think about the needs of somebody with autism, which actually cuts across other neurodivergent conditions also. So S standing for sensory needs, P predictability, A acceptance, E is for education. And so the sense that actually, also actually I think E stands for empathy. So going through some kind of framework anyway, you know, I think might be helpful for the person in a position of authority, you know, to be thinking about it. Because actually you could probably even do that even before having the discussion with the individual. You know, if we think about all the experiences and literature around, say, people from a different gender or sexuality kind of background coming out, you know, I think that there's a sense that we really need to respect the timing for that individual. So, but it doesn't mean that we can't put in supports in the meantime. So I think that having frameworks like that, and there'll be lots of others, actually to consider a profile of needs, that can be really helpful for that teacher, you know, consultant, supervisor, you know, to be putting in even before, you know, they're having the individual conversation.
I think that's a really helpful approach, and maybe we can link that model in the sort of show notes. So you sort of touched upon the question I was going to ask, which is about thinking about whether if someone had a diagnosis, what sort of adjustments we should be considering. But I think that's actually what you've suggested is we can start putting those supports in place and considering our approach even without a diagnosis. But I'm just wondering if there is a sort of diagnosis, I guess it's very dependent on that individual, but what sort of things should we be thinking about doing, especially in an education setting? Or how can we make our environments a bit more inclusive and make sure that our learners are not, you know, unintentionally excluded?
So yeah, so going back to that acronym, the first two in terms of sensory needs and predictability, you know, these are quite tangible. So being conscious about whether either the lighting, the sounds, you know, the constraint of physical space might either be overwhelming for that trainee or student, or actually the opposite. Actually, that's fine, but maybe they just need access to a movement brick, for example. In terms of predictability, I think that helps both the very organized autistic person that wants to know kind of what's coming up, but also the person with ADHD traits that might kind of like, you know, struggle with organization a bit more kind of thing. Actually, having predictability helps them, you know, kind of prepare and find a way to then not let their disorganization, I guess, you know, be such a big impact upon then the delivery of whatever is occurring forward. This is a real challenge because I'm sure lots of listeners to your podcast will know that as the NHS has evolved, these are two areas that actually I would say has become a real challenge, isn't it? So I think when we're thinking about physical spaces now, because of constraints of resources or because we're growing and we have much more technology and we need to get more people into, you know, the healthcare settings that we're in, it's actually really difficult to think about some of these sensory aspects. When it comes to predictability, when I did my first SHO job, I had my rota for the whole year. And now with some of the trainees I support, you know, it's not uncommon that they get their rota 2 weeks before they move post. So I think that actually we need to recognize that the current environment for all sorts of, you know, quite complicated reasons, I suppose, you know, makes it really challenging, I suppose, to think about those reasonable adjustments. It starts off with us thinking, what are the needs for the people that we're trying to support? And then trying to think systematically through a framework like SPACE to think about accommodations, think about reasonable adjustments that could be made.
Thank you so much. I think we've covered everything I was going to ask you today. I'm just wondering whether you have, and you've covered lots of top tips throughout this conversation, whether you have any kind of key messages or top tip you'd like to leave our listeners with, really thinking about valuing and supporting our learners and trainees with neurodiversity?
I guess the first would be to really embrace the fact that it's diverse. Even using medical language, it is well known that seeing one person with a neurodevelopmental condition is seeing one person with a neurodevelopmental condition. It's such a highly heterogeneous set of needs, and then has a very heterogeneous way of how it then impacts upon the life of that person and the system of, you know, their family, their friends, their colleagues all around them. So that's that bit first thing, to just open our minds up to that. The second is for us to reflect on our biases, for, you know, the things that might be things that build up towards stigma, so that we can work towards acceptance better. I think there's really important place here for role models. So, you know, people with neurodivergent conditions, doctors and medical students being those role models themselves, actually. You know, I think it would be a disaster if someone like me was still doing a podcast like this in 20, 30 years. I think it should be very much people speaking directly about their experiences, you know, kind of educating others. From a training and education perspective, there have been some really good gains from a national perspective. So certainly with autism, there is a national autism plan. It was actually mentioned in the King's Speech. And there's national training called the Oliver McGowan training that's due to be rolled out nationally, or is in the process of being rolled out anyway. There isn't going to be a difficulty for people to access training. As with any training, you know, especially when it's released nationally, people need to think about how that's individualized to their particular settings, their particular specialties, their, you know, the kind of context of their, I don't know, their physical kind of like location and space. So I think an encouragement to listeners to, you know, not just treat it as one of these things where you go for the generic training and then, you know, that just means that you can just take those principles and just apply them straight away. It needs some thoughtful, you know, kind of meaningful ways of application that requires some thinking, and best to do that in collaboration with people who have neurodivergent conditions.
Thank you, Ashley. I think that's really helpful. And maybe the next time we have a conversation like this, we can make sure we have some learners and hear those voices, and kind of definitely food for thought for me. But I really appreciate your time and sharing your insights and your expertise, because I think, you know, what comes out really, really clearly for me is that idea about really kind of noticing differences and supporting people and supporting our learners and really thinking about it on an individual basis. And so whilst there's lots of training out there and an increased awareness, which is great, I think we still have quite a bit of work to do as individuals, but also as kind of organizations to, you know, shift and adapt and support our learners. So thank you again for this conversation. I think there'll be real value for all the people that listen to it and thinking about one little thing that they might be able to do differently, having heard us speak today. Thank you. We really hope you enjoyed that. What were your thoughts or comments? Leave us a message. Let us know how that landed. What are you going to do differently or try out in your own education practice? And just a quick reminder, the views expressed in this podcast today are those of the individuals involved and not of their respective organisations. Happy learning, and thanks for listening.